Welcome to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom. In this show, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the UK opposition, didn't go to his first Privy Council meeting. How important is that? We hear from former Labour Mayor Ken Livingstone. Also, Daniel Craig has said he'd rather not play James Bond again. We find out why. And a look from Share Radio at the new Roomy app, which they're calling the Tinder of flat hunting. First, the latest global headlines from the AB Newsroom.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. Angry lawmakers got right to it this morning as Volkswagen's top official in the U.S. faced them and apologized for the company's cheating on emissions tests.
Did VW install the software for the express purpose of defeating emissions controls?
To our understanding, and this is also part of the investigation, it was installed to this purpose, yes.
Volkswagen's Michael Horn.
I would like to offer a sincere apology for Volkswagen's use of software program that served to defeat the regular emissions testing regime.
Lawmakers are asking what the fix is, how dealers will be affected by slow sales, and who specifically is responsible for this. A warning to owners of some GM SUVs, the company is warning them not to use their windshield wipers because an electrical short could cause the wiper motor to catch fire. GM is recalling thousands of new Buick Enclave, Chevy Traverse, and GMC Acadia SUVs. NATO Secretary General calling Russia's military actions in Syria troubling. He spoke at a meeting of NATO defense ministers in Brussels today, where the British Defense Secretary Michael Fallon called what Moscow is doing dangerous. He says there is something the Russians can do to help the conflict, rein in Syria's President Bashar Assad.
The single most helpful thing they could do is use their influence on Assad to stop barrel bombing his own civilians, their children, his own cities and villages. That's how Russia could help now to resolve this conflict.
The risk of fire is prompting federal officials to back a proposed ban on rechargeable battery shipments on passenger airlines. The FAA says this is urgent. It says the batteries can cause explosions and fires. This is AP Radio News. She wrote about the old Soviet Union, its collapse, and the heartbreak of its people over decades of tragedy. Svetlana Alexievich has won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Our Marlin Rising is in Stockholm.
She has done hundreds of interviews with women who fought the World War II in the Red Army, a story that hadn't been told widely before, and how they fought almost at the same conditions as the men. She has also written about the Chernobyl disaster. The Academy said that she paints up the soul of the Soviet people.
Almost $1 million comes with the award, and Alexievich says she'll use it to support her writing. Atlantic City taxpayers are getting stuck with about $65,000 in security costs from the Miss America pageant parade. Organizers reportedly say they can't come up with the money. On Wall Street, the Dow is down about 8 points. I'm Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
The leader of the opposition and leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, did not take up his first opportunity to go to the Privy Council meeting today because of prior commitments. Critics seized on this as Corbyn being anti-British. Here, Ken Livingstone, the former Labour London mayor, speaks to LBC about the matter.
But after the fact that he didn't sing the national anthem, lastly, this does show he has a problem with monarchy, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, he like me is a Republican, but it doesn't mean to say you're going to abolish the monarchy. You just got to live with it. Although on principle I'm a Republican, I have to say I think the Queen's done a very good job and she's been very fair. I mean, that decision to come along and open the Thames Barrier in the middle of a campaign to abolish us was very helpful. And I just don't think there's anything he can do to avoid all this. If it wasn't this, they'd dig up something else. I saw Cameron going on about half a dozen vicious attacks on Jeremy yesterday, suggesting he's some sort of foreign agent almost working to destroy Britain. I mean, it's a bit over the top.
Daniel Craig says he doesn't want to play Bond again, with some pretty harsh words. Time.com explores.
Seems like Daniel Craig's had enough of the shaken but not stirred James Bond life. The actor, who's portrayed the British spy for three films and will take on the suave, secretive playboy for a fourth time in the upcoming Spectre movie, told Time Out London he'd rather commit suicide than take on Bond again. "Now, I'd rather break this glass and slash my wrists," Craig said when asked if he would do another Bond film. "No, not at the moment. Not at all. That's fine. I'm over it at the moment. We're done. All I want to do is move on." Craig has not hidden his desire to end his run as Bond. In an interview with Esquire in September, he hinted that Spectre was his last take on the role, but didn't completely rule out a future project, saying, "I have a life and I've got to get on with it a bit, but we'll see." Craig was candid with Time Out London about the one reason he'd even consider a fifth venture as the Steely Spy. "It would only be for the money." But for as much as Craig is over being the face of James Bond, he's appreciative of the opportunities it's afforded him and the legacy franchise's role in the movie industry, offering some wise words to his still unnamed successor. "Don't be sh**. You've got to step up. People do not make movies like this anymore. This is really rare now, so don't be sh**." That said, Craig doesn't give a fuck who plays Bond next. Spectre releases in November. This article posted by Tanya Basu.
And with the rise of dating apps like Tinder and Happn, we've become accustomed to the idea that a quick click or swipe could lead to love. But it could also be the new way to decide your housemate. A new social platform called Roomie, RWMI, is offering you a way to do just that. Share Radio spoke to co-founder Jack Archer.
To do that, and they say that they match users to compatible housemates and great places to rent as well, based on interests, lifestyle, and living preferences. And whether or not, if it was Annie Weston we were pairing you up to, whether you're prepared to fish the cold pasta out of the sink. To find out more, I'm joined in the studio by Jack Archer, one of the co-founders of Roomie. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Sue. Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to hear from you. We've all been through this experience, I think, at some point in our lives. Students share, shared house when, you know, we first go out into the world of work. And a lot of people of a certain age still preferring perhaps to house share or have a lodger or something like that.
Yeah.
I read somewhere interestingly, just not quite on the main subject today, but interestingly that the age of house sharers is actually in the increase.
That's right, yeah.
It's not 20-somethings anymore. Mm. It's not the Friends cast anymore. It's people in their 50s and 40s as well sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we're also seeing, obviously, we've only just launched, but we've already had, predominantly we're still getting a big intake of students and young professionals in their 20s. But we have seen a few roommates sign up looking for somewhere to live in their 30s and in their 40s. And I also read a piece recently in The Guardian that also emphasises that, you know, even families and older single people, perhaps they've been divorced, are also looking now to get into a house share because it's a great way to meet new people.
Actually, just as we talk, I do know of a 60-something house sharer. In Berlin, as it happens,
but nonetheless,
quite happy with his lot, actually. Quite happy sharing his living space. Let's talk about the app, Jack, and how it all works and perhaps where the idea came from.
Sure, yeah. So Roomie is a responsive website, so it means it works over desktop, tablet and mobile devices. The idea behind it is, yeah, we are creating a social platform for the rental and house share market. The whole idea is to eliminate, you know, the stress and the time associated with finding a place to live, and therefore making sure that you're living with the people you want to actually live with. So the idea, I suppose, from my own experiences, initially, you know, I came from Bournemouth in 2009 to move up to London, and I spent about 6 weeks, which is 2 weeks over my allowance, with a friend in Putney. I ended up having to pay them some rent because I was there for so long and eating all their cereal. and out of pure desperation, I moved into...
For breakfast, dinner and lunch.
exactly. So I eventually moved into a house share in Tufnell Park with three random people. And, you know, nice enough people, obviously, but I didn't really bond with them. I didn't know them well enough beforehand.
So it wasn't the makings of an American sitcom?
Unfortunately not. We barely saw each other. I was pretty much living in my bedroom, really. Or would be out of the house on purpose. And then, you know, from there, I've also had, most recently, and where the idea came from, which was 2 years ago, about 18 months to 2 years ago, we had my girlfriend's sister come up and stay with us, and also in exactly the same boat, coming up from Yeovil. We had a tiny one-bed flat in Putney. She came up and, you know, she was with us for about, I think, 6 weeks again. trying to find somewhere. She
That's
has
a
some
lot of time
story.
On someone's sofa, isn't
it? It's a lot of time. It was a bit of a drugs den, to be honest, the lounge. No drugs, obviously, but it was pretty messy.
Metaphorically speaking.
So that's where the idea came from, and I thought there must be a better way. I was using Spare Room and Gumtree, you know, in 2009. Yeah. People, and including Gemma, were using Gumtree and Spare Room. So yeah.
And there'll be a generation of people listening yeah. today for whom it was a card in the newsagent's window. You know, or it was a paragraph in the small ads, that kind of thing, just appealing for, you know, someone clean, well-mannered,
sure.
and, you know, perfectly respectable, come and share their highs. So how do you go about matching people? On what basis, sure. what boxes can people tick?
So basically, like I say, with the sites that exist at the moment, they are quite clunky and difficult to use. And what I was realising is that actually people are allowed to just message people off the cuff without any kind of background. They've got no profile. You don't know who's on the other end of that listing. So with Roomie, what we do is everyone on the site will have to create a profile. Mm-hmm. That includes, you know, a first name, images. And then what you do is you select key tags that are based on your interests, your lifestyle and your living preference. So maybe at the moment it's fairly broad because we've just started out, but things like if you're a bit of a night owl, a bit of an early morning person, where you're fairly tidy or a little bit messy, let's be honest, some of us are.
Yeah, but who's going to admit to that?
You'll be surprised there's a few on there that have admitted.
You know, who's going to say, you know what, I leave my socks in the bathroom.
Well,
I leave used food in the sink and I never do my share of the chores. Who's going to admit that?
I think you'll be surprised there's a few I've seen that are on there with a bit messy tag. So, yeah, I'd put my hand up to that. And some people do, you know, they want a bit of mess involved.
I suppose, people who are naturally messy don't want to live with a neat freak. That's the other side of
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
I guess. And who are you attracting on the app at the moment? We were talking there about the average age of those who want to house and flat share. Are you attracting, 20-somethings, 30-somethings or more?
Yeah, I think the average age at the moment is about 26, which is probably to be expected. However, like I say, we are starting to see some slightly sort of older generation coming in, and there are students, but there's going to be peaks and troughs also with the students coming in when they need to look.
So what can you do on the app then? Can you say tick the boxes that say you want a 30-something female who's a professional who wants to live within, 30 minutes of the city, yeah. something like that, whose preferred area is Battersea or Clapham or something?
Yeah, you pretty much nailed it there. I think the idea really is we can do a lot more and we can definitely drill down further on the matching criteria. Initially, it's fairly broad. So to start with, it will be, but you know, matching with roommates that are looking to live in your area, the right budget, obviously the right gender. And then you can also, within the search filter, drill down further on their interests and things like that.
Okay.
And then the idea there is that obviously you're not able to then just contact these people directly. You just click a smiley face button, which sends a notification to the other person saying you're interested, you like the look of their profile or property. That gives you the other user the time to then see who has just liked that, you know, your property. You can see who they are and what they're interested in.
How precise can it get? I mean, can you state, you know, keen cyclist?
So at the moment,
hates Asian food.
I mean, these are tags we can definitely add. Yeah. I think initially, like I say, we want to keep it fairly broad just because of the number of users on there initially. So at the moment, it would be such things as sport, reading, socialising, health and fitness, cooking, that type of thing. So at least you've got a general interest. And then hopefully, because we still encourage people to meet, you know, we're not saying book it all online. It's important who you live with, you meet them first. Mm. So I think the idea is that creates enough of a common ground for them to then go and meet and talk further.
Did you ever see the film Single White Female?
I have seen it. Yes.
Because I'm just wondering if some people might be a little cautious over a forum like this at the risk of meeting other people online. You know, we talk about online safety, sure. don't we, in very general terms a lot. The business of, you know, sharing your life essentially with someone you've never met before. I'm sure you would urge caution. What measures are in place to keep people safe?
So basically, in terms of the platform itself, the only thing that's actually shared is the first name, an image, obviously, of you or whatever you choose, or the property, and then your key tag. So unlike other, you know, listing sites out at the moment where there are like mobile numbers, there's email addresses on show. You don't need to give any of that out.
All of that's hidden.
It's all hidden, completely hidden. So it's only first name and image that you'll see.
And what do you advise would be housemates to do in terms of meeting each other and sizing each other up?
I think, you know, I suppose in a sense that's where the, you know, we are similar to dating, and that we'd always recommend that you go somewhere in public. Mm-hmm. So maybe it'd be a pub, a cafe, where there's other people around, and in an environment where there are other people, really.
Okay, and that would be advice that you would carry through for users of the app or the site as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, like I say, we we understand that sometimes people are quite desperate or there's a rush to find someone. And the idea is that we do speed up that process and make sure that you're actually, even if you are in a rush, you're able to live with the right people. But we still definitely urge that we encourage them to obviously meet up.
Do you provide the facility for people to agree up front on shared costs, bills, that kind of thing, the kind of behaviour that is expected?
Yeah, and I think that can be listed because there is a free form box where in the description they can describe, you know, the type of person they're after and how they live as a house. And obviously when they do match, if they do successfully match, within there they can discuss, because it's an inbuilt chat system, so they can discuss other things like that.
I could see how this actually could work really well if you're quite clever with it. I mean, say you're a couple of 40-something women who want a hot young fellow, you know, to occupy their spare room. You know, that could work.
I mean, that isn't the Tinder element of the app, to be honest, but...
Well, other apps do that. Or, you know, two young fellas wanting, you know, a French lady, you know, to come share their apartment with them. You know, it could work out that way.
It could. It definitely could.
But that's the whole point, actually. It's about lifestyle preferences. It is. And it's about, you know, like-minded people. Yeah. Sharing a space, that the assumption being that if you've got shared interests from the start, that might be a better basis for getting on. And on getting on, you must hear naturally about, you know, horror stories of when it goes really well, when it goes really wrong as well. We've all been there, you know, marking, you know, the milk container and stuff like that, sneaky messages, you know, on the fridge
door. Absolutely been there, yeah.
You know, well, who stole my sandwiches?
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully, I mean, the idea is that this will hopefully eliminate that, or at least go some way to, you know, to kind of stop that happening.
I think it's a great idea, actually, and I wish you well with it all.
Thanks very much.
Where's it available at the minute?
So at the moment, we've launched just in East London. The idea behind that is... Well, we looked initially at the number of house shares in all the different boroughs in London, and that had a very high number. So we went with that, and obviously some great people around that, the Old Street Creative Hub. So we've launched there initially, but like I say, the plan is to roll out pretty much imminently across all of London. We've had a really good uptake already. I've got about 60 roommates on there in about 5 or 6 places. So we're looking to expand across all of London very shortly after.
Okay, so perhaps beyond London as well. You know, house sharing's on the up, I think, across the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, predominantly it will work very well in the built-up cities. Obviously, London is such a hub for that with all the jobs as well. And the amount of people that are here, it makes sense to start here. But we would love to go over to, you know, not only the UK, but other countries as well.
And discussing the latest news, here is the Pacey The Briefing from London's Midori House and Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 8th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in today's programme...
My concern is that the Russians are... not mainly targeting ISIS, but they are targeting other opposition groups, and they are supporting the regime. And I call on Russia to play a constructive and cooperative role in the fight against ISIS.
NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg there raising concerns over Russia's military actions in Syria. We'll have the latest. Then, as the federal court rules that Dilma Rousseff's government manipulated its accounts, we ask if the Brazilian president could face impeachment. Also ahead...
Historically, Canadian magazine market and North American magazine market has been more geared toward subscription sales rather than newsstand. I think that's a defining feature vis-a-vis the UK or Europe.
We continue our series on newsstands and the business of selling print. Today we're in Canada. And later in the programme, we'll profile the new artistic director of Balenciaga. All that and much more ahead right here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. A busy show in prospect, as always. Let's begin, as we like to do, with a look through some newspapers here. Casting an eye over the North American headlines for us today is Monocle's Marcus Ippi.
Good afternoon, Tom. Let's start on the US West Coast. Los Angeles Times title, Putin's Syria gambit shows up US. As Russia escalates its offensive in Syria, Obama is left looking weak and indecisive, critics say. Indeed, in Washington, there's quite a few political leaders who are criticizing Obama for not doing more to stop a war that has killed killed. More than 200,000 people fueled Islamic State and sent hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing to Europe. On the same front page, something lighter, why Hollywood is all a buzz. It's been only 1 year since the Federal Aviation Administration cleared the way for the use of drones in film and television industry, and indeed the Hollywood has fallen in love with that. For obvious reasons, it's so much cheaper. A camera, drone and a crew costs as little as $5,000 a day compared with a helicopter that's at least $25,000 a day. The Washington Post then, Hillary Clinton has now announced that she is opposing this expansive 12-nation Pacific Rim Free Trade Accord finalized by the Obama administration this week. She says that she's been following that, she supported it earlier, she's been following that, and now she's concerned. She thinks that the bar should be set higher. That's something, that discussion is going to continue for a while,
I bet. It certainly is, yeah.
And then finally, moving on to Canada, Conservative leader Stephen Harper has suggested that a re-elected Conservative government would consider legislation banning niqabs for anyone dealing with or working for the federal government. And on the front page of the Toronto Star, this paper has interviewed Muslim women about how they feel about this idea, and they say that they feel like they're being used for his election games and they are concerned.
Marcus, back on your home territory in Finland, do people still kick around the idea of, you know, Islamic dress? Is it a political hot potato, or are people a bit more relaxed about that kind of thing?
You know what, it's really interesting, because I don't think Finland has quite reached that state yet. We don't have that many Muslim women over there wearing their niqabs. You see it sometimes, but it's quite a rare sight. And it draws attention when you see those women. It draws attention in good and bad. So I think Finland is still, it's not very international. There's still some learning to be done in that country.
The insights there from his homeland and on the North American papers of Marcus Hippi, joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is 4 minutes past the hour, 13:04 in Brussels, where our next story takes us. NATO defence ministers are gathering in the city to assess the troubling escalation of Russia's military activities in Syria. The use of cruise missiles, as well as airstrikes, and the recent violations of Turkish airspace has raised some concern among NATO members. In the meantime, as we heard at the top of the show, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has said the organisation is prepared to send troops to Turkey and defend its ally. Well, joining us with more on this is Mary Dejeski, commentator on Russian and European affairs and a columnist at The Independent here in London. And on the line from Brussels is Danny Kemp, AFP's Deputy Bureau Chief in the Belgian capital. Welcome both to the programme. Danny, perhaps just coming to Brussels first of all, what do we know so far? How are talks progressing, and what are you hearing where you are right now?
Well, we're hearing a fairly hard line from people going into the talks. Certainly, we're hearing from Michael Fallon, the British Defence Minister, who's saying that the recent Russian moves are making a tense situation even more dangerous. And we've also heard him talking about Britain moving more, putting a deployment of troops through the Baltics, moving that eastern front back open again. And we also heard a hard line from the Germans going in. It's clear that there's a lot of concern among NATO. It was Turkey that called for a special meeting earlier this week because of the violations of its airspace by Russian airplanes. As we're now waiting for the result of the talks later, when we're going to hear from Stoltenberg. But we're expecting some tough language, although that may be the extent of it at this moment.
Well, indeed, Mary sort of chuckles to that notion. And Mary, what do you think Russia's reaction is likely to be? I mean, will it just be, I don't know, will they be completely unconcerned if it is just empty rhetoric?
I think they probably will be completely unconcerned, because I would have thought, if you were looking at it from Moscow, the prime concern was that nothing should go wrong, that the risk of an accident, of getting bogged down, of something happening which might prompt a confrontation, whether with Turkey or the United States or somebody, that at the moment, I think, is the prime risk. Otherwise, I would think that Russia is profoundly unconcerned and would actually be prepared to turn around to NATO and to the Western countries who are operating in whatever way inside Syria and say, well, you know, you said that you were going to take on ISIS. You said that you were going to support the toppling of Assad. Now show us. You've been doing this for 2 years and you've achieved nothing.
Well, let me ask you about that then, because there was some talk, I don't know whether you would consider it just to be wishful thinking, as it turns out, that Putin and the Russians were actually interested in some respects, joining that alliance and actually tackling IS. Was it only wishful thinking? Was Putin only ever playing his usual long game?
Well, I tend to think that it was genuine, because when Putin went to the UN General Assembly, he gave this speech, which the centrepiece of which was basically an appeal for what he called, I think, a broad multilateral international coalition to take on ISIS of the sort, he said, that was put together to fight Hitler in the Second World War. Now, you know, it didn't seem to me that this was really, that this was sort of empty rhetoric. It seemed to me that he meant it. And it may be that in the talks that followed with President Obama, they spent 90 minutes together after they'd both spoken at the UN, that maybe they couldn't reach any agreement. And maybe then Putin turned around and said, OK, well, you know, you haven't had a great deal of effect in Syria so far. We're going to act unilaterally. And that's basically what they did within hours.
Danny, let me ask you, obviously, it's difficult, as you've already mentioned, to sort of preempt what else we might hear later today. But do you think there is a genuine appetite, certainly within NATO, to actually deploy troops to Turkey, for example? You can understand why they're saying that. But is there really an appetite to see that happen?
I don't think there's any appetite for that at all at the moment. I mean, certainly, in fact, we've been hearing from NATO officials who've been rowing back on that slightly and to say that this is in theory rather than that, you know, that this is a possibility that could be, you know, that could play out if need be, but that it's not that they're not on the point of doing it, or that they're particularly ready to do it. What you may see, however, is the Patriot missiles that are on that are in Turkey, that protect the border there and the airspace. They're due to be pulled out quite soon, or imminently, in fact. What you may see is that they are then these U.S. missiles are kept there at Turkey's request. This is not going to be something that the Russians have never been happy about, those missiles being there. This is something that's going to make them even more unhappy, I think. So that is, I think, what is more likely to happen, rather than there being any question of more NATO troops there. Don't forget, though, of course, that the US is already operating out of Turkey's Incirlik air base. Turkey recently agreed to that. So, in fact, you've already seen an increase in the number of NATO forces there.
Mary, let me ask you about that then. Do you think that this could be seen as almost provocative to the Russians? We've seen also, you know, Ankara summoning Russia's envoy a number of times with each of these different incursions into Turkish airspace. How does it play out? What happens on the ground? Will there be more of these sort of diplomatic to and fro's? Will it get into more of a sort of tit for tat? What would your reading of the situation be?
I think it's very, very difficult to predict, because practically every move so far has been unpredicted. Mm. But what I do think is that maybe Russia understood that it was sailing a bit close to the wind with the violations of Turkish airspace. And I think the rather muddled response to that they weren't quite sure whether to admit it or to say it, I think they said it was a mistake. That suggested to me that it's something that probably won't recur, or it won't recur deliberately. I think that Russia has always, and especially in Soviet days, it's always been very, very sensitive about the borders with NATO, so that the border between Syria and Turkey, which is essentially a NATO border, I think they will be quite careful about that. I also think that it was almost an expression of sort of powerlessness, at least on the British side. Of course, we don't have officially airstrikes operating inside Syria. When the Defence Secretary said this morning that Britain was going to supply more troops to be based in the Baltic states. I mean, this sounded like something which was sort of, on the one hand, profoundly irrelevant to the actual fight that was going on now, but something absolutely designed, as it were, to put Russia on, to put Russia's nose out of joint, almost the minimum you could do to sort of maximum irritating effect.
Just briefly, one final point, Mary. What about you alluded to this already earlier, this Russian notion that, you know, Western policy has broadly been a failure, that there are other forces to support, that there's other courses of action. Do you think we could see, if this sort of paralysis that continues in Syria and without continues, that actual notion gaining traction, that there's a Russian view, if you like, becoming slightly more widely held, even amongst some of the Western participants in the alliance thus far?
Well, I think the Russian position so far has been very, very consistent over the last 2-3 years. And it has said that Assad and the Assad regime have to be part of the solution. And with the West support for various rebel groups essentially failing to bring down Assad and failing to provide a credible alternative, I think there is probably a strand of opinion that says, OK, let's see what the Russians can do, and that everybody will then position themselves for some settlement that will either involve a possible partition of Syria, or it will involve in everybody shoring up the Assad regime if he agrees to some sort of talks and a more a government which has maybe slightly less one-party air about it.
Mm. The insights of Mary Jeske, columnist at The Independent, and on the line, Danny Kemp, AFP's Deputy Bureau Chief in Brussels. Thanks you both very much for joining us here on The Briefing. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It's exactly 14 minutes past noon here in London. Off to Brazil now, where President Dilma Rousseff just lost a major legal battle after the federal court ruled that her government manipulated its accounts in 2014 as an attempt to disguise a widening fiscal deficit as she campaigned for re-election. This is the court's first ruling against a Brazilian president in almost 80 years. And even though it's not legally binding, it paves the way for her opponents to argue once again for her impeachment. Let's hear now from Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent, Sheena Roster, who joins us on the line. Sheena, great to speak with you. Maybe let's start with that big question. We've had opposition leaders hugging and cheering when this ruling was announced, but could it actually spell the end for Dilma, in your view?
Well, despite all this, she did say yesterday that she will not resign. She will not be resigning. So if the opposition does want to impeach her, they could start that process if they want to. But there still remains questions around if they will actually move forward on impeaching her, how it will happen, and namely when it will happen.
Let's get stuck into that then. What is the time frame like? We've already mentioned that this isn't necessarily legally binding, and we've seen these whoops and cheers. Do we know what the actual legal ramifications are and what the time frame could be?
Well, there is some speculation that the ruling Workers Party is going to take this to the Supreme Court and they're going to be looking to have the decision overruled. It's difficult to see if that actually will happen, because this is such a major blow to the ruling party. And also, they already tried to delay the ruling that was announced yesterday, but the court refused to do that. So this has kind of been a few months in the works, because back in May this year, the opposition was already accusing Dilma Rousseff and her government of manipulating fiscal accounts in order to meet their accounting targets. And in order to disguise a widening fiscal deficit, which was happening before she was going up for her re-election campaign in October of last year. So there has been a lot of talks, and there's been a lot of perspective on this in the past few months, but things do tend to move a bit slower in Brazil. So if there is an impeachment, it will still be a few months in the works.
The glacial pace of that, yeah, could be remain to be seen. Sheena, let me just ask you to put this in some kind of broader economic context, though, of course, because one would imagine this is pretty bad news, more bad news for the Brazilian economy, a recession, the worst in, what, almost a quarter of a century. The currency's performing badly. It's lost a lot of value against the dollar. Does this just make a bad situation worse in broad terms?
Definitely. You know, investors had already been pulling out of Brazil, and investor confidence has already been incredibly low due to the corruption scandal with the Petrobras allegations, which have been developing since about March 2014. So that's already been hurting Dilma Rousseff's popularity, which has plummeted. She only has an approval rating of about 7%, which is likely to go even lower after yesterday's ruling. So the Brazilian economy is doing horribly. It's the worst recession in 25 years. The Brazilian real is the worst performing currency of all global currencies this year. It's lost 70% of its value against the dollar alone. And the currency actually did take a bit of a nosedive yesterday when this ruling was announced. However, with markets opening now in Brazil, it seems to have rebounded slightly today. But Brazil, the Brazilian real, just to give you an idea how bad the economy is performing, the Brazilian real was only created in 1994. Back in late September, just a few weeks ago, the real had an all-time low. It closed at an all-time low, which just goes to show how bad the economy is doing. And it's not over yet. It just seems to be getting worse and worse as the opposition just starts to dig deeper and deeper.
Worrying times for Dilma, and more worrying times ahead, it seems. The view there of Monocle's Sheena Roster in Rio. Sheena, thanks very much for joining us on The Briefing. We'll be back right after this.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special Monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong, or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week for our brilliant new travel programme. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic, emerging cities around the world. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
Almost 20 minutes past the hour now. All this week on Monocle 24, we've been celebrating the newsstand. Why? Well, it coincides with the opening of our new kiosk cafe just next to Paddington Station here in London. So as a result, we've been travelling around the world looking at how different places pick up a copy of their daily newspapers or their favourite magazine. Today, we're off to Canada, where the newsstand is, sadly, often perceived as a dying breed. But Chris Frey, a frequent Monocle contributor in Toronto, told Ben Ryland it isn't time to panic just yet.
The way the magazine market has kind of happened in the last 20 years is bifurcated, that we've never had a strong tradition of the, say, the street level newspaper or magazine kiosk. What we've had first are specialty magazine stores, certainly. And I think the lack of the street level kiosk may have something to do with the weather and the frequently inclement winter weather. You know, those street level kiosks may have simply been blown away or sort of snowed in for 3 or 4 or 5 months out of the year. And another interesting aspect too may have to do with sort of the urban design of Canadian cities, that outside of Quebec, many of them were originally envisioned as these very modest Protestant cities that have vastly, vastly outgrown themselves. And so we don't really have those large sidewalks and boulevards that you find in many, say, European or Latin American cities. So you simply don't have the space. I guess, for that kind of sidewalk level, you know, magazine, newspaper, kiosk. Well, we have had our specialty magazine stores, certainly, but in the last 20 years with consolidation and the rise of the mega bookstore, I think you'd find more and more Canadians buy their magazines, if they buy magazines, at those mega bookstores. Like in Canada, we have the Chapters, Indigo chain, and, you know, similar to the US where you'd have like Borders. I would also say that, you know, historically, Canadian magazine market and North American magazine market has been more geared toward subscription sales rather than newsstand. I think that's a defining feature vis-a-vis the UK or Europe. So, you know, especially magazines would often offer deeply discounted rates on subscription, so vastly cheaper than buying at newsstand, with all sorts of other gift incentives and frou-frous that they would try to offer people to get to sign on. We do have a magazine culture. It's not quite as strong as you'd find in the US or the UK. Some of that has to do with scale, the size of the Canadian economy, and the difficulty in distributing across such a vast territory. And I think the other half may to do with a lack of innovation at its retail level or among magazines themselves.
What is the appetite like for the newspaper and more international titles amongst Canadians?
Well, I think it's there. This is the difficult thing. And this is where, to some fault, I blame, if I may, the Canadian market and the level of imagination that exists among Canadian publishers. Because, you know, even though we live in international context and all these different titles are available to us, I do feel that Canadian publishers and Canadian retailers have a role to play, a leadership role to play, you know, in terms of like demonstrating, like, here's the great titles that are out there and here's what we can aspire to creating. I mean, certainly the internet has been a huge factor. By most measures, Canadians have some of the highest rates of connectivity and online readership. So the decline we have seen in the last 10 years in newsstand sales is compounded by just the reality. More people are getting their news and entertainment from online sources. But the fact that at retail level, we've been very slow to see the influx of all these exciting titles that are happening, that are being produced in the UK and in Europe and in some parts of the US anyway, is one measure. And then the other is the fact that I think among Canadian publications themselves, I think they've feared for their life, as so many other print publications have, to the extent that they've been confining themselves to playing it safe and trying to sort of keep close to the territory that they have. One has to keep in mind that, you know, given economies of scale, what might be considered a large magazine in Canada, say, you know, a circulation in the hundreds of thousands of copies. I mean, the largest Canadian Circ magazine is probably around 400,000, 500,000 copies per issue, if you were to combine subscription and newsstand. And by the US standards, you know, not too long ago, that would have been considered a small magazine. You know, we're one-tenth the population. So in terms of the resources available to titles and the willingness to experiment and innovate, whether it's among small or large titles, become somewhat constrained. And I think that's where there's been a lack of imagination in Canada. I think there's certainly a hunger. Canadians are very well connected. They do read titles from around the world. I think one, you know, encouraging mark is that we are seeing more of these curatorial boutique-y type stores, if I may say, like somewhat like the model of the Monocle store, that are opening up and aren't necessarily devoted to, you know, a large swath of magazines, but are, you know, picking a nice tight collection of 10 or 20 titles from wherever. And they're doing well. I just think it's one of those cases where there needs to be more players in the market that are leading rather than playing it safe and following.
That was Chris Frey, our man in Toronto, talking to Ben Ryland about Canadian print. And you can visit the Kiosk Cafe in Paddington here in London right now. Head along if you're passing by. You're listening to The Briefing. Twenty-five minutes past the hour, and finally, on today's show, we turn to the world of fashion. Demna Gvasalia has just been appointed as Balenciaga's new artistic director. The 34-year-old is the founder of Vetements, a collective that merges luxury with underground culture. He's replacing Alexander Wang at the creative helm of Balenciaga, and he will be responsible for the brand's collection and the overall image of the house. It's expected he'll stage his first show for the brand during Paris Fashion Week next year. Well, joining us to discuss this is Sagra Massiera-DeRozan, Monocle's luxury correspondent. Sagra, welcome back to The Briefing. Great to speak with you, as always. First of all, tell me, what do you make of this appointment? Is this good news for Balenciaga?
Well, I am. First of all, I'm intrigued about it. And second, when you look at the signers that Balenciaga has appointed as a creative directors over the last few years, it kind of is a little bit in the same line. You know, like 15 years ago, it was Nicolas Ghesquiere, which was, again, at the time, a little bit of a rebel or outsider to a very established house and name like Balenciaga one. Then it was Alexander One, you know, just 3 years ago, which again, it was like very kind of a street, young, American, the son of the king. So I'm not surprised that this house has appointed someone that is quite, you know, unusual or unique, right, to run the business. Yeah, I mean, it will be interesting to see what his interpretation of a very, again, classic and home will be.
Well, let's look a bit more detail at that, Sagra, because you've got this background at Vêtements, of course, which sort of merged, you know, luxury with, as we mentioned in the introduction, sort of aspects of underground culture, and that picks up that theme you've mentioned there of being a little sort of edgier. Do you think that that's then a good decision strategically to stay in that same kind of territory, or was the sort of the market more widely and analysts and commentators maybe looking for a bit of a change of pace, a change of style?
Well, I think this will bring a little bit of a change of a style. I mean, the reality is that in the last 3 years, Alexander One, who is a wonderful designer and built a phenomenal brand, Alexander One himself, I don't think that they kind of click, and I think it didn't drive Balenciaga into a new direction or into a new place. And it's kind of, if you look at the landscape of a luxury brand, it was lagging behind a little bit, that's my sense. So I think that the appointment of Demna is going to try to kind of get back to the front lines in terms of innovation. I mean, from the times like Nicolas Ghesquiere, I mean, Balenciaga was the thing and the brand. So I think it will bring a lot of buzz. And I think, you know, one of the things that it was surprising to me, it was like then when you were reading some of the comments in online and on the press, it was like everybody was commenting on the timing of the announcement, right? Having to do with when you know, simultaneously to the show of Nicolas Ghesquiere at Louis Vuitton. So it definitely brings some buzz into the brand, which it have not had for a little while. Now I don't know if you can just build a luxury brand just on the back of buzz, but it certainly helps. And I think it will also bring in like a new, younger customer, which is, again, a paramount of many luxury houses to stay relevant. If you think about that, again, one of the most successful of the last 3 years has been Yves Saint Laurent, YSL or Saint Laurent now, with Hedi Slimane. And he also has brought like a very, very young aesthetic and a very young zeitgeist into Saint Laurent.
Exactly. Well, we'll keep a close eye on what happens next. Sagra, thanks as always for joining us with your insights. Sagra Masira de Rosen on the big luxury stories of the day. That's all we have time for on today's briefing. Thanks to our producer, Carlotta Arabello, and our research team, Guy Lutz, Federica Romagnello, and Ines Fresinet. Our studio manager was Wei Dong Lin. Thanks to them all. Join us at the same time tomorrow, noon, here in London.